Jennifer.
And I'm Teo.
Yeah, and we are the collective today. Teo is joining us for the first time. He was making amazing calls earlier to come to the AGM. So if you are a CITR member and you're listening, you should come to the AGM. Do you want to give your spiel?
Sure, yeah. So if you're available, March 28th on a Wednesday, that's 2 weeks from today, and it's from 6 till 9 p.m., there's going to be drinks, food, prizes, more drinks to forget the memories, but it's going to be great. It's going to be a great time, so if you can go, please show.
Yeah, so for CITR members, you should come out because you can vote for who's going to be on the exec next year, and it's a really good time. So, yeah, we were listening to Teo giving amazing calls to all the members. So, yeah. So on today's show, we are going to be joined first by two members from the Grad Student Society to talk about some of the needs of grad students and how the AMS is or is not addressing those needs. And then we're going to be hearing some songs, or a song from Seventh Row, which is the band that won the BVP Band Wars earlier this week. They're like a metal band on campus. They're really cool. People were moshing at the pit when they were playing, which I was so like pleased to see. It was pretty raging on a Tuesday night.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. And then we're going to be hearing from the UBC Learning Exchange and how they are fostering learning in the downtown east side. And then last, we're going to be talking about crazy roommates and how to deal with crazy roommates. So that's on the show today. So yeah, first we're joined by two members of the GSS, and they're also UBC journalism students. So Taron and Kaylin. Did I get? Yeah. Okay. So yeah, welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so you guys are part of the Graduate Student Society. So what is the society?
The Graduate Student Society is the independent society of 10,000 graduate students of UBC campus. We advocate for the rights, for the needs, for the I would say for everything regarding the graduate students who live on UBC, in Vancouver, who study and live in UBC campus.
Yeah. So, what kind of like how would you differentiate like a graduate student experience from an undergrad student experience? Like, what's kind of different between doing your undergrad and being a grad student?
I personally did not do my undergrad on UBC in UBC campus, but I can tell that being a graduate student is a very stressful experience. There are so many deadlines. It's not an exam kind of system. We don't have like annual exams and then you are done. We actually have a lot of submissions of deadlines, submission of theses, submission of assignments. And there's a very high expectation in terms of deliverability, in terms of expectations from grad student compared to an undergrad student. And from my own undergrad experience back 6-7 years ago, it was really, really very, very casual and very easygoing life, I would say.
Don't make me scared. Like, we're undergrads, and I'm like, I don't want to face that.
Again, it's a different age group. You can actually, you don't have to worry about getting a job at that moment. You are you can enjoy your life. You can dance, sing songs, make mistakes, do so many things at that age group. But being a grad student, it's a totally different life, I would say.
Okay, okay. Wow, we're going to dance and sing songs.
I thought it gets better after you graduate, but I guess not.
So do you feel like a lot of pressure from being in grad school? Like,
yeah, okay. Yeah. It is. Again, we all find some opportunities to enjoy ourselves in our own ways. But in terms of the kind of life we live, it's very different from undergrad students.
How are you guys enjoying the journalism program?
Oh, it's good. It's good. I would say there are so many deadlines. Again, there are so many deadlines, and it's a very practical program which is offered by UBC. And we study as well as we have to work. And we also have to meet all those deadlines. So it's sometimes really stressful when we are approaching those deadlines. But overall, I think it's a very, very loving community of journalists from all over the world. And we learn a lot from each other. So it's an enjoyable experience. But I would let Kaylin explain her experience.
Yeah, I think, you know, I guess for me, I was heavily involved in my undergrad. I did my undergrad in Ontario, and I was joining every club I could find. And I think the difference that I find now is I kind of took some time away before I came back to school. And so I kind of feel like I've chosen a career field now that I want to invest way more time into. And so before, I think balancing and time management was a big problem for me, trying to do it all and be involved and meet people. And I think for me, the difference now is that I see all these clubs that I want to join and I'm like, oh, if only I could do that. But I kind of have to take a step back and think, well, no, I'm here because I would like to do well in this program and I want to show that I'm invested in this as a field. And so I think it just changes. And I'm not saying everyone's like that. There are some people, obviously, that still kind of dip into a lot of different pools. And I do miss that. It's myself as a person, I just can't. I'm that type of person that can't manage too many things at once. I just have to focus in. So so to be honest, I miss those days of kind of doing a little bit of everything. But for me, that's how graduate school has changed my perception of university and what it's there for.
Yeah. So maybe like a lesson for undergrads would be like experiment when you're in your undergrad, when you have time to experiment with
advantage of your.
Yeah. And UBC has so many clubs like for every interest that I think you can really find so much variety here, like, yeah.
And I'll talk to that quickly, which in my undergrad, we didn't have a journalism program. I was interested in it. And so instead I joined the reporting team for Queen's Television. And I also did a bit of writing. So I did find a way. I knew it was an interest back then. So I did kind of find a way. And I think that is one of the advantages to the clubs, is that even if maybe you're not studying something that directly aligns with what you're looking for, I think the clubs do offer an outlet like that. Potentially for what you're looking to pursue in future.
Cool. That would be so fun to have a UBC television network. Queens has a TV.
It was pretty great.
Oh my God, that's cool. I would want TV. Yeah, okay, so you guys just had your AGM. So do you want to kind of talk about annual general meeting, by the way? That is the acronym. So yeah, what happened at the AGM?
Yeah, so as a society under the BC Society Act, we are entitled and we are required to hold an annual general meeting each year in the month of March, where we invite all the members of the society, which are like 10,000 graduate students, but actually not everyone can make it to that meeting. But we need at least 1% members to be present in that AGM to make some important decisions for the society and in which direction in the future we are going towards. So recently, I think 2 days ago, very sure that 2 days ago, we had the AGM, and the biggest thing that everyone was interested to look at was how we are going to go ahead with the relationship with AMS right now. So in 2015, it was decided again in the AGM that we will hold a referendum in 2018. And yes, just following those decisions made back then, we were preparing a referendum question, which we are again in the process of. We ran out a survey back in January. And based on that survey, we will prepare a solid referendum question. But during this AGM, there was a report and presentation about where we are at and what grad students might want in terms of the relationship.
So what do you think grad students want? What does it seem like?
Graduate students are, they represent 20% of the population of the whole student community on UBC campus. And they demand, I think, inclusivity. Like they want to an inclusion and not considered as a separate entity or separate population or demography. In those terms, they want equal access to all the services provided on UBC campus, provided by UBC or the AMS or GSS. In those terms, they just want equality, and they want all those services they pay for. For example, they pay for the health and dental plan. So again, they are getting those services, but there are so many services which they expect to receive, but they are not getting right now.
So graduate students do pay fees to the AMS, like the same fees that undergrad students pay. But there are services that you are kind of prohibited from using or like?
So graduate students pay exactly the same fee as all undergrad students pay towards AMS, but they also pay a fee towards GSS. So they are members automatically when grad students join UBC, they pay a fee towards AMS and GSS. in terms of definition, they are not stopped from accessing any of the services. But in terms of practical ground realities, what we see is there is, I don't see any graduate student run club in the EMS Nest.
Mm-hmm.
And this Nest was built by the money collected from grad students as well as undergrad students. So when EMS collects the fee from students, they don't differentiate. But in those terms of providing services back to students, they kind of favor undergrad students.
Yeah, well, because I actually didn't know up until like the elections that just happened with the AMS that graduate students were even a part of the AMS. I just assumed you guys were under your own kind of organization. And it was weird because, yeah, back in, I don't know, September, October, yeah, I was at like a Blank Vinyl Project drop-in. And yeah, someone came by, if I recall correctly, who was a grad student, and they were basically told like, yeah, you're not really kind of like allowed to join because the AMS has like discouraged clubs from, or has like, yeah, basically told clubs that like grad students are kind of not supposed to be a part of it, which was really weird to me because if someone wants to join that club who's a grad student, I don't see why that's any different from an undergrad student, especially if they're paying fees. So yeah, it was really weird to me. And then to hear that like you guys are paying AMS fees, I really don't understand why someone would be prohibited from joining. Like, that seems strange.
Yeah, exactly. I would just say the same thing, that it is in terms of how grad students are treated. It's no policy that they should not join or they cannot join. But again, they are not invited. They don't feel invited. They're not made feel that they are part of the same community.
Do you feel like there's a kind of a like separation between grad students and undergrad students on campus?
I think there is some differentiation. There is. I feel like grad students, they do not get involved in too much activities which are done by AMS, too many events that are held by AMS. I don't see many grad students participating in that. Again, as far as their interests, they always are looking out what is happening in AMS. They're interested.
Mm-hmm.
They definitely have a lot of interest into these events in AMS, in the council. They read a lot of stuff. They discuss about a lot of things. But in terms of participation, I think there is something that stops them.
Okay. So what do you think kind of will ultimately happen? Like, do you think that like grad students will kind of vote to separate from the AMS, or...?
It depends on the outcomes of the survey. So this referendum question will be prepared based on the survey, which has been sent out to grad students. We didn't see a lot of participation yet, maybe because of the exam period. But we have decided to continue to run that survey to prepare that referendum question, and based on that, either there would be a split from AMS, a probable split,
mm-hmm.
or there would be a cut in the services which grad students pay towards AMS. So there might be so many services that grad students don't want from AMS anymore. And so, yeah.
Which services kind of in particular do you think grad students don't really utilize from the AMS?
So right now, we collect the survey. Again, that survey data does not represent a considerable amount of grad students. So I cannot say concretely about those findings. And I think it would be inappropriate to say anything right now.
Okay.
But whenever it's right time, whenever we have a concrete data, we will be glad to provide that.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. So so a referendum, I guess, is kind of pending? Like, it's
due this year. So okay. In 2018, it definitely is going to happen.
Okay.
From my understanding, it should happen in November this year. But again, my term ends in a month. So it's a question for the incoming execs.
Oh, okay. So are you graduating soon or?
Yeah, I'm trying to.
You're like, I'm getting out of here.
Almost there.
Nice. Okay. Cool. Okay. Well, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay. So up next, we're going to hear a track from Seventh Row. The metal band that we talked about before, who was started a mosh pit at the pit, and it was really fun. So this is their track, Another Place, and they won the Band Wars, and so they're going to be playing at Goose Hunt, which is happening March 31st at Kerner's Pub. So it's UBC's music festival, and this year the theme is psychedelic. So yeah, they're going to have like giant mushrooms set up all over Kerner's Pub. It sounds like fun. So yeah, you guys should check it out. But this is Another Place by Seventh Row.
As I waited inside my head, far from the crowd. Every second Wednesday of the month from 6 to 9 is Women in Career Night at the Bike Kitchen. Bring your bike and give it some love in this safe and positive space for anyone who identifies as female or queer. Come learn how to fix your own bike with the help of a female or queer-identified mechanic and volunteers. Plus, there's free pizza. Visit bikecoop.ca for more information.
Women in Science Club provides support for female undergraduates in science fields. Our club has three pillars: mentorship, building community, and connecting people. We offer networking events with alumni, professional development workshops, as well as an ongoing mentorship program to support students through challenges that arise for women pursuing careers in science.
Okay, so we're back on UBC Happy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, and we are broadcasting from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory, and we were just talking to two members of the Graduate Student Society, and two, they're both in the School of Journalism here at UBC, about, why they kind of are looking at separating from the AMS. So speaking of AMS, so the elections happened last Friday, the results were announced, and we were all over it. We did 2 weeks of AMS election stuff, so we're kind of pros on the subject. But so the winners were announced last Friday, just after our show ended, so we didn't have a chance to kind of talk about who actually won. But we're going to announce it now, just so that everyone's updated. So the president, drum roll, was Maryam Hamid.
Yay!
Were you guys expecting that?
Kind of.
I was between her and
Rodney.
Yeah. I only know his last name, the little mustache. But it definitely was not going to be Andy.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't think it was going to be Andy, yeah?
No, of course not. Like, who? No.
Well, okay, so on the AMS results, so you can actually see, they made like an Excel spreadsheet. I should also say that the AMS elections, when you went to their Facebook page, they kind of messed up the first time in announcing like who won, and then they said, okay, you have to go see. Anyway, it was kind of a little bit messy, but so they did kind of compare each of the candidates kind of to one another. So like, so between Maryam and Andy, Maryam got over 6,000 votes and Andy got 800. And then between
800 people voted for Andy.
Yeah. And then between Rodney and Andy, Rodney received 4,000 and Andy received 1,000. And then between Maryam and Rodney, Maryam received over 5,000 and Rodney received almost 2,000. So you can kind of see like proportional how they kind of stacked up to one another. So basically, Maryam kind of came in first, Rodney came in second, and Andy came last, which didn't really surprise me based on kind of student opinions on it. Maryam's going on to be president.
Good for her.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of referred to her as the Hillary Clinton, quote unquote, of the campaign because she was...
She's a woman?
Well, because she has so much experience with the AMS and AMS politics and stuff, so she's kind of really like the one that you would kind of think was gonna win. So
she was really well spoken too when we interviewed her.
Yeah, she,
I really
like
that.
Yeah, she had a pretty like well-rounded platform. So she won. She did win. VP Academic and University Affairs, that one only Max Holmes ran, and he did get elected. but for those who voted, it was basically whether you kind of were in favor of him being in the position or not. So out of the yes and the no's, so 6,156 students voted yes to him being in the position, and 746 students voted no for him being in the position.
Why?
Yeah, I don't really know why. I'm wondering if some of those are from like the frats and maybe they were like bitter.
Yeah, probably.
I don't know. But or there just aren't like even 700 students in the, or students who don't even know. So
yeah.
I don't know. Or maybe some people don't like his platform and they didn't want him.
It's a big number though.
Yeah. So I'm kind of actually surprised at how many voted no. So VP Finance, it was between Adam Forsgren and Cool Akubenhi. I'm sorry if I'm butchering that. So Cool won. He won with 4,529 votes versus Adam with 1,719 votes. Yeah, that one was actually a really kind of unique result because Adam is in a frat and he was kind of very much integrated into the Greek system. And I believe the past three VP finances have been from the Greek system and they've all been from the same frat. So the fact that Cool won and who is not part of a frat at all is actually kind of unique
refreshing
to campus. Yeah. So, yeah, it's kind of a lot of frat boys have run the VP finance for a long time. So times are changing. And I wonder if any of that has to kind of do with Max's, openness about, like, you know, the open letter rejecting the Interfraternity Council's endorsement. Like, there was a lot of criticism of kind of Greek life within these elections. So I wonder if that had anything to do with it. I don't know.
Potentially. I don't know. I didn't know too much about all of that. So I don't know if other students would have known about that issue as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not sure either. But yeah, Cool one. So for VP admin, there was Chris Hakeem running against Aaron Verones. So this was the tightest race. So Chris won with 3,361 votes. And Aaron had 2,460. So, yeah, a bit closer than the other races. To me, they kind of had, like, the most similar platforms, I kind of thought. So, yeah, but Chris won. And for VP External, the winner was Christina Ilnici. And she won, and she was running against SG Krishna and Michelle Tahir. So, yeah, so she won. So that's who won. Okay, so then moving on to the referendums. So we talked a lot about the referendums on last week's episode because there was a really controversial referendum, the one with the fee restructuring. So basically, all of the referendums were voted yes, but two of the referendums did not receive enough votes to actually pass. So, okay, you pass. That one passed.
Yay.
Yay. I mean, not that I'm going to be a student next year, right, but for all the students, I'm really happy for them.
For those who don't know, it was to keep the U-Pass. So if we voted no, you would have had to pay like a regular bus pass fee instead of the $40 that I think is subsidized. Or it's $40, but just subsidized.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So that was a good one to vote yes for.
Yeah.
Yay.
So that one passed, and that one passed. Yes was 10,509 votes, and no was 363.
I think those people didn't know.
I know. I'm like, who are those people? Find them. And, so in total, like over 11,000 students voted in that referendum. So removing student court, this one did not have enough votes to actually pass. So
I'm still confused what student court is. I would like to go to it.
Yeah, we were talking about this. That, so,
I don't mean like I want to be on the stand.
You're like, I want to be on trial. Like,
I want to
judge
be
me.
The jury.
How do I become jury?
I don't know. Like, wait, what
jury
if you get
duty?
Summoned for like jury duty? Like, you receive a notice in the mail. You're like, you must show up to UBC student court, or you will be kicked out of UBC. You're like, what? This is crazy. So. But I don't think that's ever gonna happen because no one knows what student court is. Slash, no one.
Like, so where is it? Who's
yeah,
involved?
So apparently,
what is it
like,
for?
It was. So I guess it was. My understanding of it, which is not very good, was that it was intended to kind of like resolve disputes among students, which what that means, I don't know. Like, I don't know what that's supposed to mean.
Yeah, disputes about what?
Like petty disputes.
Yeah, I don't really know what they're kind of supposed to, what type of disputes and like why the AMS would be like responsible for resolving disputes. disputes among students. But anyway, but I guess like it hasn't really been used since I believe it was like 2010. Like, so it's been years that no one's been using this. But I guess there's still kind of money going into it or like resources going into it. So anyway, this is what I don't really fully understand this. But basically, I think because no one actually knew what the student court did, not enough people were able to vote like yes or no for it. So anyway, yeah, it has, because, yeah, out of like the 11,410 students that voted, almost 7,000 of those students abstained from voting. So, yeah, it didn't, it hasn't actually passed because it didn't receive enough votes. And then the fee restructuring proposal that we talked about last week that was kind of run so poorly, in our opinions, that one also, it was, the majority voted yes, but it's not passing because they didn't receive enough votes. So, yeah, almost 5,000 students who voted abstained from voting. So, yeah, out of the 11,400, yeah, almost like half of those students abstained. This, and then the Sustainable Food Access Fund passed. So, ooh, yeah, so sustainable food on campus, it's it's happening. So those are the results from last week. So, yeah, your AMS, that's what's happening.
What's up?
That's what's up. okay, so up next, we're going to be hearing my interview. I sat down with Matt Hume from the UBC Learning Exchange. So we're going to hear that. And then when we come up back to close the show, we're going to quickly talk about like roommate horror stories. So, yeah, this is the UBC Learning Exchange. So this is Alex Lenz at the UBC Learning Exchange with CITR, and I'm joined by Matt Hume. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good.
So could you please introduce yourself and what you do here?
Yeah, so I am the current student learning coordinator at the UBC Learning Exchange. I'm also a UBC master's student doing my MA in language and literacy education. And my role here is to facilitate student learning, whether that's students visiting us just for one morning to find out what the Learning Exchange is all about, or they want to volunteer with us on an ongoing basis, or even if there's a faculty member who wants to have some community-based experiential learning for their students, I can help facilitate that as well. So anything student-related that comes to our doors, it's my job to help them out with their time here.
Awesome. So what are some of the programs that are run here?
Yeah, we have two main programs. When you walk in our building, you're immediately in our drop-in and connecting through computers program. And so that offers free computer classes every morning of the week to low-income community members. And those computer classes cover everything from Microsoft Excel, which I could probably use some refresher in myself, as well as PowerPoint, Microsoft Word, just using the internet. And we have both basic and advanced level classes. And we're talking basic, we're talking a lot of times we are starting from absolute scratch. One of the moments that really surprised me when I first started working here, I was walking through the drop-in program one morning, and they asked the people, I think it was the first day of class, and they said, all right, who here has ever been on the internet? And this was only a couple of years ago. I assumed everybody's been on the internet by now, and only about half the people in the class put up their hands. And so with the basic program, it's really trying to facilitate digital literacy in the community, and that's one of the things that we really focus on is digital literacy in our computer program. In the afternoon, after the computer classes are over, the drop-in opens up to the community, and we have free coffee for people to come in and enjoy if it's a cold, rainy day, as you do get in Vancouver. People can just sit on the computers and use them for whatever they want. Some people just want to watch music videos or research whatever they're interested in, so you can do that. We often have people playing guitar and singing downstairs. We have documentary days on Wednesday where we show a documentary and facilitate a discussion afterwards. And so that's our first floor is our drop-in, which is an absolutely vibrant, incredible space. And then on the second floor, where we are now, is the English Conversation Program. And so that offers, again, free classes to low-income members of the Downtown Eastside community. And those classes are very conversational in nature. We don't drill them on reading, writing, and arithmetic here. We usually have a facilitator in the room who's given a topic for the day. They can talk about that topic or something else if that's what people want to talk about. And they have 75-minute long conversation sessions that are very social, very easygoing in nature, and lots of fun for the participants. So those are our two main programs, the English Conversation Program and our drop-in.
Cool. So
So it's called the Learning Exchange.
Yeah.
And yeah, so kind of a big aspect of the UBC Learning Exchange is that, you know, the students can learn from the teacher and vice versa.
Yeah.
So yeah, could you kind of talk about that idea of exchange of learning?
Yeah, and so the teacher-student dynamic is something that I know exists quite a bit on campus, and we tend to avoid those terms here at the Learning Exchange. And that was, again, something that I had to learn when I first started working here, was to not use those words anymore. We tend to use the words facilitator for somebody who's running one of our workshops or one of our classes. We use the term learner for somebody who is participating in those, and we just have our patrons, who are the people who just come in and access our drop-in services. And because the teacher-student dynamic kind of has a one-directional transfer of knowledge implication to it, where the teacher is the giver of knowledge and the student is the receiver of knowledge, we don't approach education that way because so much of our education is very informal and unstructured. We find that by using those terms, the facilitator is the one guiding the topic, the learner is the one participating in it, but quite often the learner is sharing stories about their life or their skills, where the facilitator is learning just as much from the participant as they are from the facilitator. And so everything that we do, whether it's the English classes or the workshops we have downstairs, everybody is learning from one another. And it's, like I said, it's very cheesy, but that's the nature of the name of the Learning Exchange. Every moment we have here is a moment of learning for everyone involved. And whether that's a UBC student, a community member, or one of the staff here, we're all engaged in learning from one another, learning from our patrons. And so that's one of the things that I really like about this place, and hence the name. Yeah.
Cool. So how are the programs kind of designed to facilitate that aspect of exchange?
Yeah, I think it's because everything we do has the social aspect first and foremost, and I think I already kind of described how that happens in the English Conversation program. Again, there's not a lot of writing going on or a lot of correcting grammar or pronunciation. It's more just social improvisation, having a conversation with someone and hopefully learning language skills through that. And a lot of what we do has an arts-based focus because arts education is not only low barrier, but it's also very, like, low anxiety form of education. Well, I don't want to say that we're, like, tricking people into learning through the arts, but sometimes that's kind of how it goes, you know what I mean? We have we had a drama club that ran for 2 years with seniors in the English Conversation program. We have a choir, and we have a storytelling class, and those are all through the English Conversation program. Very, very social experiences for everyone involved. And we don't graduate people through the English Conversation program. If somebody shows a large amount of proficiency, we could ask them, hey, you're currently a level 2 English learner, do you want to switch to level 3? But we find that people don't come here to gain a large amount of proficiency. They come, again, for that social experience. And so if we ask them to change out of the class where they've now made friends over the past year, they're friends with their facilitator, they've been sharing their life stories with these people, if we say, okay, you're now out of that class, we're graduating you, we've discouraged that social experience by doing so. And so I think that by kind of allowing the room for people to make those social connections and learn within those social bubbles, if that makes sense. Same thing downstairs is that when we're offering a workshop, it's more people are telling stories the whole time that they're doing whatever they're doing. If they're sewing and fixing clothes or they're fixing their bike, they're sharing their information with one another. And I think by putting the emphasis on the social aspect first and foremost and everything else comes secondary, that's how we kind of enable those learning moments to happen. And sometimes you walk away from a conversation with somebody and you don't even realize what you've learned through that interaction. And that happens a lot of times to me in my time here. And so I think that's really valuable, is just putting the social emphasis on everything that we do in our work.
That sounds so nice. So how did this place begin, the UBC Learning Exchange?
Yeah, so we've been around since 1999. We were in a little bit of a different building than we are in now, about 4 blocks north of here, and more recently we moved into the space we're in now. And in 1999, UBC identified, and there was a large movement at that time towards universities participating in community engagement. Moving into the new millennium, universities across Canada, across the world, identified that if we don't actually connect to the communities that we're working with, that we're researching within, we're not going to survive. And so UBC identified that we need to have some kind of community engagement. And again, because the UBC campus, as beautiful as it is quite disconnected from the rest of Vancouver. It's like its own beautiful little world, but it is quite distant from the downtown Eastside community. And so I think UBC really identified, like, if we're going to be asking the community members to do research there, and we're going to have people working down there, we need a presence that actually exists within the community. And so that was the genesis of the Learning Exchange. they did quite a bit of community consultation at the time. We didn't want to just pop up and then pretend like we had all the answers. So in consultation with community, we found out that people wanted a space at the time. I mean, 1999, the internet was just becoming big. It was becoming a tool that everybody needed to enter the workforce and even just to communicate with one another. That's a skill that you needed. And so when we did our first round of consultations, we kind of said, what skills already exist in the community and what skills do people want to learn within the community? And people said, hey, I know computers or I want to learn computers. If we had a drop-in computer program or registered computer classes, could we offer those as a way to, you know, start connecting with community members? And so the drop-in and the Connecting Through Computers program was the first program that we offered, and it was incredibly successful. It's grown quite a bit since then. Later on, when we had the capacity to grow, again, we went back to the community and did consultation, and they said, hey, we want to learn English just because of our proximity to the Chinatown community, and there are so many immigrants who live in and around the Learning Exchange. They said, I want to practice my English, and we had other people who said, hey, I can facilitate English classes. So we opened the English Conversation program, again, as a way of giving a home to something that was already going on in the community. This was a skill that people had that they wanted to share and a skill that people wanted to learn. And we base everything that we do off of that model. Anytime we look at offering new programming, we kind of say, does this meet what's called an asset-based community development model, the ABCD model? Asset-based community models, the opposite of that, I guess, would be a deficit-based model, when you say, I'm going to look at the problems that are within the community, and I'm going to use my money and my research to try and solve those problems. And the creator of the asset-based community development model, John McKnight, kind of identified that's not necessarily a good approach to community engagement. Instead, if we looked at what are the great things already going on in the community, what are the skills that people already have there, people already know how to use computers, or they want to facilitate these English classes, if we gave those a home to network and grow and connect, maybe that's a better way to kind of approach community development. And so everything that we do is based off of that asset-based model, by looking at something very positive or a skill that people really want to engage with, and then we give it a home here and hope that it grows and connects.
Yeah. Cool. So, going back to research that's mm-hmm. done here. So I guess you kind of mentioned that like UBC wanted to open this place up because they were doing so much research in the downtown east side. Mm-hmm. So the UBC Learning Exchange does participate in research. Mm-hmm. So is that is the research done here also kind of based on this exchange model?
Yeah, definitely. We've started something in the past couple of years called the Making Research Accessible Initiative. And so I think when a lot of groups come to the downtown east side, they don't realize, number one, how many research requests are given out here. A lot of the people, the community members have been asked too many times to have research done with them or on them. And so there's a little bit of research fatigue, I think, in the community, as well as a lot of people don't consider, if I'm going to be doing research in the community, how am I keeping that research within the community and giving that research back to the community instead of just extracting that information and bringing it back to the quote-unquote ivory tower? How is this community benefiting from the research and not just the person who's doing the research benefiting from it, if that makes sense? And so when somebody does come to us with a request to do research, we kind of make sure that they understand that if you're going to do research here, it needs to be participatory. It needs to kind of stay within the community. It can't just be for the purposes of you publishing your article or your thesis, and we never see that work again. And so the Making Research Accessible Initiative, things that we have done in the past, and it's only been running for a couple of years now, but if we're actually reaching out to anybody who's done any kind of research in the downtown east side, whether they publish an article or their thesis, and we've asked for kind of an unpublished version of said article, and we want to put those on a public repository on the UBC Circle to make sure that they're accessible to downtown Eastside community members, not just people who have a campus-wide login and people who have access to the UBC library. How are downtown Eastside community members able to access this wealth of research that has been done with them in the community? And so that's one of the ways that we're trying to kind of make the research really accessible back to the community, as well as a lot of the projects that we do are very participatory from beginning to end. There's an example of, we have a program called the Learning Lab, and so that is very informal workshops and things like bike repair, clothing repair. We have a Mahjong club that runs weekly out of that one as well. And so we saw all these really great things happening in the Learning Lab, and we said, let's find a way to celebrate what's going on or explore how has this benefited the people who are participating in these programs. And so a program called Voices Up came out of that, and so they collected all the stories of the people who had participated in these workshops and these activities, and they turned it into a play, but the community members who wrote the play actually served as the actors in the play as well. So again, they participated in the writing of the script as well as performing that script. And the great thing about this particular piece was that it was very flexible in nature. It would be equally as entertaining and educational for a faculty member as it would for a community member, as it would for an academic, a non-academic. Who doesn't like to see a play, right? I mean, it was a really cool way of taking data and collaborating with community members to share that with all different kinds of audiences. And so they did a number of performances of the play. They did it here at the Learning Exchange and at different conferences, and they performed it all over the place. And then again, they said, okay, now we have all of this data about what it means to create a play based on our experiences. What do we do with that? So then they all wrote, drew, illustrated, put together a comic zine about their experiences doing the play. And so now we have a copy of that available. It's on our website, and we share that with patrons. But it's always been a participatory approach. The people who are doing the research are involved from the conceptualization of said research to the dissemination of the research. And so that's one way that we kind of approach research here, is that we really want to make it as accessible to everybody involved as possible.
Yeah, I'm looking at the zine right now, and I'm thinking I would much rather read my class papers in a zine than in dry text.
Yeah, it's a heck of a lot more fun, and we don't overly jargonize any of our publications or anything. It's just a lot more fun to see a play or read a comic than it is to read yet another scholarly article. Not that there's anything wrong with scholarly articles. I publish them myself, but sometimes it is nice to get a little bit of a different way of disseminating that data, and especially if community members are participating in it. You get to see them presenting this back in their own words. I think that's a lot more impactful. Impactful than just reading it in, you know, some journal that you found online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. So how can kind of like UBC classes learn here? Like, are you finding that professors kind of use this space for their students to learn?
Yeah, so I guess there's a couple of different levels that that faculty and students, I guess, have engaged with us. So we're very fortunate to have an orientation package that's kind of developed for if a class wants to pay us just one visit. If there's a class that has some kind of component about community-based education or marginalized peoples, we usually invite the class through connecting through the faculty members to come and pay us a one morning or one afternoon visit. And we've developed a series of orientation videos called Shifting the Story. We identified that we wanted to change the perspectives of the Downtown East Side. A lot of students, especially students who didn't grow up in Vancouver, have heard a lot of negative things about the Downtown East Side, whether that was through media or through, you know, online research. They knew about the negative things that were going on in the neighborhood, and we wanted to change the perspective to match our asset-based model, because we see the great things, the assets that are going on in the community. We wanted to find a way to share that with students and faculty who are visiting us. So we interviewed six different community members. Originally, it was just supposed to be one orientation video, but we got so much good data from that, we created a series of five videos, part of the Shifting the Story series. And so when a class comes to visit us, usually we'll show them one of those videos. If it's an economics class, we have one on social entrepreneurship that we can show. If it's just people who know very little about the Downtown East Side, we have one that's just about the community and its people. And if people want to do research with us, we have one that's advice to students working and learning in the Downtown East Side, but it's in the community members' own words. This isn't us from the Learning Exchange telling the main campus what you need to know about the Downtown East Side. This is community members describing the positive aspects that they see in the community and the challenges that they face. And so we usually show that as a way to kind of orient people. Here's what the community is. Here are the assets that are going on. And then we send them on a neighborhood walking tour. We've developed a set of tours that are completely self-guided. We give you a map and a set of locations, and you walk around with a partner and go visit some of the great things that are going on in the neighborhood, whether that's art galleries or safe injection sites or Carnegie Hall, which is the Carnegie Center is the they call it the living room of the Downtown East Side, just because a lot of people go there to socialize. And so they get to visit all these different great things going on in the community. They get to see them firsthand. And so even if they just come to us for one morning, we kind of try and show them the positive, the asset-based side of the community. And so that's one way that we've engaged faculty and students, is just we just call them one-off visits. You want to come down to the Downtown East Side for the morning, and we'll show you the great things that are going on here. We do have increasingly courses that are actually run out of the Learning Exchange as well. We have an adult community-based education, ADHE 330, under the Faculty of Education, that runs here every Thursday afternoon. And so the students are not only doing their coursework here on the Downtown East Side, but they are also engaging with different community-based projects. So they learn in their class, and they go out and they connect with different community members and community-based organizations and complete some work with them as well. And we also have community field experience students from the Faculty of Education who come with us every year. We have FlexMed students who offer health workshops for our drop-in and our our English conversation program. We have an urban ethnographic field school cohort who spend over a month every day of the week with us. Coming up in a couple of months here, they'll be spending some time with us. So whether it's just they visit for one morning or they want to run a full course, a full semester out of here, we're very happy to host faculty and students, and we hope that they find their time here very engaging and educational. Yeah.
Yeah, so, because I'm thinking, you know, back to, like, when I was in first year, and especially, I think, you know, some people who come to UBC kind of just to study, and they kind of live on campus, and they don't see much else of the city. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so kind of how are you trying to kind of get students, like, off campus and here? You know, to kind of, yeah, have more experiential learning.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I personally identified, I have a background in international education, and one of the things we found is that a lot of international students were arriving to UBC, whether they were doing like a Go Global exchange program and they were only here for 4 months, or they were planning on studying here for their entire undergraduate. But when they arrived, they were, they get the kind of the Vancouver orientation, and they say, hey, go to a Canucks game while you're here, head up to Whistler and go skiing, do all the really cool stuff, go to a Richmond night market. Don't go to the downtown east side. And we were finding that messaging was coming from the campus itself. It was coming from if they were placed with billeters, they were telling them not to go to the downtown east side. And so these international students were arriving terrified to come to this part of town. And so I connected with some of the incoming exchange programs, and I actually was able to present to a group of about 150 incoming exchange students about the learning exchange. And even, like I said, trying to change that perspective and saying, just come down for a morning and see what we're all about. If you want to volunteer during your 4 months here, that would be a great way for you to, you know, see some different sides of Vancouver that you might not see if you're only kind of doing the really cool touristy stuff. And so we saw a big influx of international students volunteering with us this term because of that presentation. And when they get here and they connect with our patrons, we have one guy who's visiting from Mexico. His name's Camilo, and he runs a weekly art class where he just sits in the drop-in at a table, has a couple of chairs next to him, and he just puts up a sign that says learn to draw. And we've had some of our very long-term patrons just sit with him, and they chat, and they just sketch all afternoon, and they're telling stories from each other's lives, and it's these really cool moments of connection, and that wouldn't have happened had we not reached out to the international students saying, no, don't be so afraid of the downtown east side. It's a really great place. Come on down here and see it for yourself. And so that's one way, I think, that we try to get students to come visit us, and we try and find opportunities to reach out to students as much as we can to encourage them. Just come down for that one day. Anytime we get a student volunteer even who just finds out about us and reaches out through email, I don't make a list of volunteer opportunities. I say, you know what? Come down. I'm not going to tell you what we have available. I want you to come see it for yourself. And that's kind of the first step of the student says, no, not for me. Or sometimes they think that we're on campus. They say, where on campus are you? And I say, no, we're very far off of campus. Come on down to Maine and Hastings and we'll talk. But if they take that first step and they say, you know what? I will come down. And they spend a morning with us. Usually they just spend an hour in the drop-in to see what that's all about. And by kind of actually coming down to the building, to the community, and seeing the work we do instead of just describing it by email, I think that's the best way to get the right student volunteers, if that makes sense, is because they come down and they identify, this is a really cool place. I never would have come here on my own, but because I heard about it in that presentation or I came across their website and I took the step to actually come down here, this could be a really great place for me. And so I think that's the best student learning opportunities that pop up are when people do come and experience for themselves, and sometimes that turns into very long-term volunteering opportunities.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys have a lot of flexibility for volunteers, and it's really based on kind of what they're good at and what they can kind of like inspire in other people, which is really nice.
Yeah.
It's not boxing people in.
It's only because when he reached out, the art student I mentioned, he said, like, I'm only studying here for 4 months, but I have a background in art that's both, you know, visual art, computer art. I mean, I can do all different kinds of art. So is that something you need? And of course, I mean, anything arts-based, or if you do have that kind of unique skill, we can find a space for you to share that with patrons if it's the right opportunity. Absolutely. Students come to us with an incredible variety of skill sets. I mentioned I did a drama club for 2 years, and that was only because when I applied for a job here, I mean, the job itself was, this is a different role than I'm doing now, but it was very clerical in the job description. It was maintaining a database and registering new learners. But then they took the time to get to know, okay, so aside from doing all that stuff, what else, what do you like to do? What do you do for fun? And I'm a theater guy. And so I said, well, my background is in musical theater. And they said, how would you feel about running a drama club? So they took the time to get to know my interests, and they gave me the room to kind of, you know, share that with the learners here. And so we ran the the drama club for about 2 years. We now have a seniors choir, and that was because we had a co-op student who came to us who was able to play piano and facilitate that. We have a dance class because one of our work-learned students has a background in dance, and so she runs a dance club for the seniors every morning. It really depends on when we do get student staff or student volunteers who come to us with that unique skill or that thing that's kind of near the bottom of their resume, but we're like, hey, that's kind of cool. How would you feel about doing a workshop on that? Those are the really great moments here, and those, I found it so personally gratifying to like that they took the time to get to know what my other skills were. And so when I first started working here, I knew I wanted to do a thesis. I had been a teacher for 10 years in the public school teaching drama, but I was like, I don't know what I want to write about. Like, I feel like I need to go out and experience some stuff. And my work with the drama club actually became my thesis. It shaped me personally and professionally because I got to see a way that my skill set was applied in a very informal, unstructured, really fun way, teaching a drama club to English as an additional language seniors, you know what I mean? So that became my thesis. It became my passion project. I was able to bridge my studies with my passions in a way that I didn't anticipate. And I think a lot of students who come here have that moment where they're like, I'm actually using my something that I really love to do to connect with other people and share that skill in a really unique way, in a really, really low stress way, you know what I mean? It's so low barrier, low anxiety programming that we have here. And so a lot of students just really get to enjoy sharing their skill with others, and they're not being judged on how they do it or put through these rigorous tests to make sure they're doing it just the right way, you know what I mean? Like, it's very, very low pressure, and you just get to kind of share your talents and your skills with other people. And I think that's the best part of what we do here, I could almost say. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really, like, nice to hear, because I think that often, in this kind of, economy that we're living in, I think for a lot of young people and young students, it's kind of, I think sometimes, like, we're discouraged from kind of following, like, passions or kind of engaging in hobbies that aren't necessarily going to, like, put us forward in our careers or something, you know, like, if you love to dance or something, and it's like, well, are you going to be a dancer? Well, why are you dancing? You know, because that, how is that going to affect your career? But yeah, when you can kind of, like, give back with those skills to a community that's so positive, and it sounds like you can really kind of put what you love to really great use here.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. It's been well said.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much, Matt. And you guys have, like, a website. People can find you online. And do you guys have, like, social media people can follow, or?
Yeah, we have a Facebook account that we update sometimes, and we are on Twitter as well, so you can find us on there. We're in the process of revamping our website, so it will hopefully look a lot better than it does now in a couple of months here. But if you're interested in visiting us just for the morning, if you're looking for volunteer opportunities, or you just want to know more about the work that we do, you can always send us an email. You can always give me a call, or you can email me. It's matt.hume@ubc.ca. That's matthume@ubc.ca. My job is to facilitate student learning here, whether, again, that's just for one day, or you want to volunteer with us for the whole time that you're studying with UBC. So please reach out. We're always more than happy to have UBC students come and pay us a visit. So, reach out. We'd love to have some people come pay us a visit.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so you're listening to UBC Happy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, and that was my interview with Matt Hume from the UBC Learning Exchange. So they're kind of UBC's partner organization in the Downtown East Side. So yeah, you can check them out online. And so to kind of wrap up the show, we're going to quickly talk about dealing with roommates that we don't get along with, because one of our contributors to the show earlier this week in our meeting kind of came in a bit flustered, and she had kind of had like a dispute with her roommate. Have you guys ever had like weird roommates that you've had to deal with?
Oh my God, so many. I always somehow end up with like messy roommates. The girl I live with now is really great. Like, I'm the messy roommate, and like, I'm pretty clean.
Okay.
So it's kind of, it's bad. But I remember living in like student housing, and like, I bought a dish rack, and no one used it. No one would do their dishes. And I was like, hey, like, can you please do your dishes? I didn't buy this rack for home decor to, you know. So I just, and then it got to the point where you had to take your own toilet paper into the bathroom.
Oh my, oh, because like, no one would buy it?
Yeah. No one would buy it. And it was just like, ugh, okay. And it's just like these stupid conflicts that like nobody can talk about, especially when you're younger. You don't know how to deal with issues like an adult. So they just like fester, and like other people's lifestyles are, you know, someone's like, oh, I don't really care about dishes. And you're like, well, I do. So do them.
Yeah. I think it's like you make a good point when you're young and it's kind of like your first time living on your own and you're living with roommates. You haven't really had to like hands-on deal with those situations before. Like you weren't the one who was responsible for dealing with them. So it's like the first time for everyone. And how do you kind of navigate that?
Yeah, like don't take your shoes off in the middle of the doorway. Like what? I just was so bad. I just boggled my mind when I lived with people like that. Like I have to open the door and like step on your shoes. No one else. You I would probably be yelling at you, Alex.
Why?
I don't know. Because you're like, yeah, my God.
No, I'm pretty clean. Yeah, I think it's more like my room that gets messy, but like the kitchen, like I have to have a clean kitchen because I love to cook. Yeah, so I just can't like deal with that. But yeah, I've mostly only lived with like friends of mine. I haven't lived with many strangers, or like not strangers, but like, you know, just people who like we're just living together. We're not friends outside of that. So I think it's a bit different. But I think that sometimes that complicates it because a roommate dispute could kind of become like a friend dispute, which is silly and not fun. But I don't know, because Elaine, you live with
your... I live with my sister off campus, but something I've noticed with first years living in residence is that the most annoying thing are roommates with boyfriends who like sleep over or girlfriends, and it gets loud. And with joint bathrooms, you see their underwear, too. It's gross.
Oh, and you're like, oh, remnants of blood. Like,
oh. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a different, like, that's a really hard one, like, when you're sharing a room, is, like, how do you share that? Like if you want private time, like, how do you
share that? Share a room with someone who had their boyfriend sleep over?
The people I know, they have, like, a joint bathroom, but single rooms. So, but they hear everything.
The walls at UBC were not built very
soon. You would think that they would make them that way, obviously. What do they think is going to happen?
Study?
Yeah, right? Study?
Who studies in residence? That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, that's difficult. Or even, like, one of our contributors was talking about how, like, her roommate is in a long-distance relationship, and so she's on, like, Skype all the time, and that's loud as well. Mm-hmm. I think they're usually actually arguing, unfortunately, but like still relationships are weird when you have roommates. I feel like if you're like in a relationship and you know you're gonna like want private time, like get a single room. Yeah. Like don't have roommates if it's possible, you know. But yeah, Teo, do you have a quick story?
I don't have a story. Like I have a roommate right now, first year, and like I think for anyone right now that has a roommate and is dealing with problems, the best thing is just to establish and be direct with them up front really early on, and establishing kind of like private space and dealing with issues before they even happen, just to avoid any confusion in the future. That really helped me with mine. We went over a lot of like our cleanliness and when we're going to clean and what's laundry and what time's going to go to sleep. And obviously a lot of some roommates aren't as organized as that or willing to say that they'll commit to that. But it's just a good start, I think. Mm-hmm. To establish that early on.
Yeah, and even if they're not kind of willing to be a super part of that conversation, it's like you've made it clear that those are your boundaries and you're willing to like have that conversation. So just kind of setting a precedent is really important. Mm-hmm. But that's the end of our show, UBC Happy Hour. And up next is Radio Pizza Party. So tune in next week. Jen has done some interviews with on the Harry Potter book that UBC bought. So we're going to be hearing that. So stay tuned until next week. And have a good weekend, everyone.
Bye.
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 Hi, everyone. We're from the UBC Food Society.
Yummy.
And we're the only food club at UBC.
We're about feeding students, but also teaching them how to feed themselves. Through our restaurant outings and cooking workshops, we hope to expose you guys to the diversity of cultures, flavors, and food communities Vancouver has to offer.
So if you want to get involved, email us at foodsociety@gmail.com or check up on our website at www.ams.ubc.ca/clubs UBC.edu/foodsociety, or you can even join our Facebook group.